أعوذ بالله من الشيطان الرجيم. بسم الله الرحمن الرحيم. اللهم صل على سيدنا محمد وآله وصحبه وسلم. السلام عليكم ورحمة الله وبركاته.
وعليكم السلام ورحمة الله وبركاته.
Welcome to the Safina Society Podcast. We are joined today once again by Dr. Shadi Ilyas and myself, Mo'in. And we are also joined today by Brother Mas'ud. And today,
Mashhood.
I'm sorry. Mashhood. And today we're going to be talking about consumption, food, and all else, rather, over consumption. And today, the one thing that I've been thinking about is that natural food that poor people used to eat in the past was priced, you know, insanely. It is currently now priced, you know, insanely wild. I mean, I work in Philly, and if you try to find anything that's remotely natural, it's ridiculously overpriced, while processed, you know, garbage food is quite cheap, you know, very, very cheap. And it's said, you know, that a man from Ghana once went to a French restaurant and he asked for orange juice. And when he got squeezed orange juice, he said, no, I want the orange juice in the can. Yeah. I can get the squeezed orange juice in the village.
That's funny.
Right. So I want to talk about not just food consumption, maybe we can start there, but the idea of consumption and where does Islam, you know, draw the boundary lines in terms of consumption.
All right, so should I start off?
All right. I mean, sure.
So the temptations in general, the two temptations or all the various temptations that people have are for wisdom, great wisdom that Allah Ta'ala never gave anyone, didn't give us human beings a temptation of any sort, except that it was for the reason of continuing our existence. So we have shahwa of food to continue our individual existence. We have shahwa of sex for the continuation of the species. We have shahwa for money, right, to be able to do things. We have shahwa, money is a really motivator for people to do what they wouldn't otherwise have done. Right, so more money, you'll work more. Power to make responsibility have a type of glimmer around it, because nobody would want a responsibility if it didn't have some kind of initial temptation to it. Right, so power is a little bit of a glimmer or a little cloak on the sense of responsibility for others. So all these things are really for the sake of our survival and for the sake of our existence and continuing our existence. But the issue is the tempering them. And of course, most people don't temper them. I mean, anger is a type of, if you think about it, it is a passion for people. Some people love to be angry, right? And we have a movement today of youth that they love to be angry, unfortunately, right? But the idea of being angry is an idea that you need to change things. And it sort of numbs and clouds your thought about consequences. So you don't think about consequences when you're angry, but sometimes you can't think about consequences. You need to take an action right away in order to get something done, and then forget the if everyone thought about consequences, nothing would ever get fixed.
Right.
These are all desires and shahwas that people have. Imam al-Ghazali said the shahwa of the eye is beauty, of the ear is sounds, of the scent. There's all these shahwats to continue and to improve our life, but the issue is in Islam is tempering them. And I'll just close with one thing. If you think about the most materialistic nations today, according to where designer companies, and I'm talking about these crazy designer brands like Dolce & Gabbana and all these, Louis Vuitton and all that stuff, Russia and China, their biggest markets for stupid events, mm-hmm. right? They'll spend like money that Americans won't spend. And think about that. They just went through about a century or so of being told about equality and you know, the whole communist ethic, not just equality, no class and materialism and these excesses are bad, right? And they actually went such an extreme, the communists, that look where their people bounce back, right? So it's now not their people, like all of them, but it's now, you know, very noticeable,
yeah,
the consumption in those countries.
I find something very interesting about consumption and the idea of food comes to mind when, so I have a lot of family that recently came over from India, and the one thing that I've noticed is they were relatively poor back in India, and they didn't have access to the type of food that we have access to here. And one thing that I've noticed is their diet in particular was very bland and you know, a very staple type of diet. They ate almost the same thing, you know, 3-4 times a week, and that was completely normal to them. It was not normal for them to eat meat, you know, more than, you know, like once a week, right? It's just not something that they had readily available, or it was expensive, and it wasn't just something they did. And so when they came over here, having an excess amount of food was very shocking to them. And another thing is, here, especially in modern countries like America, developed countries like America, one thing that you see is you have access to the best cuisine from all over the world, right? And you have the ability to pay for it. So you're not just getting, you know, your, you know, vicinity's best biryani, for example. You know, you could go to restaurants that are highly rated by, you know, thousands of people and go get the best, you know, whatever dish. And having the access to all of that, it actually lessens the value of food, yeah, as well. It's something that I noticed. And one thing they mentioned to me is, you know, when it came to Eid, right, like Eid al-Adha, that was the one time where they ate a lot of meat, yeah, and they didn't get to see meat the rest of the year as much, right? And so, and as readily available. And so Eid al-Adha is actually a holiday where they enjoyed meat. And it's not like that here at all, right? It's not special to eat meat. I can only speak for myself, but that's how I feel.
Well, I remember, you know, having meat on Eid and not knowing what's the big deal. Mm. Like, what is unique about Eid? We're going to have lamb. But we just had steak yesterday. Steak is superior to lamb, right? So it's like, I never understood how that's a big deal. But honestly, you have to starve yourself. If you want to enjoy food, if you like food, you actually need to starve yourself so that, you know, when you do actually eat food, you know, it has some value.
Yeah. So for the past kind of week, I've been doing this kind of like thing with my diet where I only eat one meal a day, which is just dinner, right? And it's been like basically just like you're fasting, but you can only drink water.
Yeah. One meal a day is perfect.
Yeah, yeah. So I was one that really just went into eating a lot because, you know, going to the gym and going all these places and really trying to like lift and get bigger, I guess, right? And which is like, especially in the Muslim community with the brothers, it's very, very prominent. We're just getting big, getting the gains, right? Getting these meat, literally it's every day. And specifically with that, I was eating 4 to 5 meals a day, which were like smaller kind of things, but they did amount to like 2,400 calories. And it definitely put on mass, yeah, right? But the goal was like, then it just kept hitting in my head, like, you know, it's just one meal a day would be so like, because every desire, right, it's linked to, like, if you're not going to feel one desire, you're going to feel another desire, yeah, right? So if I'm going to be full, other desires will come into play. Or if I'm going to starve myself, I'm going to be focused on that. So I'm going to be trying to compensate for that.
I actually think that most people don't have this, at least in our part. Eating isn't the main issue. Hmm. There are other drives and other obsessions. Career, for example, is a form of consumption. There's no mm-hmm. doubt about it. People that care so much about their career. Mm-hmm. Like wealth is like, even people are even, there is stuff even beyond wealth, right? Today, it's not even wealth. It's more like perception. And especially amongst the younger crowd that grew up with the Kardashians, its perception is even greater to them than wealth, I think. And I think they use perception, like the Kardashians use perceptions as a means to wealth, right? So creating those, like, most people would probably want to have more likes than money. Yeah. There are some youth, I'm sure, 100%. I'm not like picking on youth, but the people who grew up in that Kardashian time, right, they would rather have likes than money.
Well, Sheikh, this has been happening for a long time. Not even just this younger generation. You know, it's been a few generations now where people, for what you're saying, for perception, for acceptance in whatever their social group is, will forget about wealth, will forego even breaking even. They'll go into severe debt just to have something that people will look at them and say, oh, well, I approve of what you have, or at least you're on my level.
Yeah.
You know, they're keeping up with the Joneses thing. This has been going on for a long time. And the ratio of debt to achieve that has just been increasing. And social media and stuff like that definitely plays a big part, because people live their whole lives for what they can post on Instagram.
And this idea of keeping up with the Joneses is what things used to be. Now it's keeping up with people that you see on TV.
Yeah, yeah.
So the Joneses, you don't even know them anymore, right? It's keeping up with the Kardashians or keeping up with, you know, Summer or the other celebrity that's on TV all the time. We don't even know the Joneses. We now know the Kardashians. Like, it's keeping up with whoever's on TV.
I mean, that's the name of their show, you know that?
What is it?
Keeping up with the Kardashians.
Oh, really? I didn't even know that was the name of it.
Yeah.
I don't know why they're famous.
That show is still running.
They're good at marketing. Yeah.
Because they're a Hollywood family.
Like, spinoffs and all of that stuff.
They were born, like, the girls grew up in LA. So I think the dad was already in Hollywood.
He was an entertainment lawyer.
Oh, really? That explains everything then.
Yeah.
And when it comes to consumption, it's also just stuff, right? I think you mentioned it in a previous podcast, but before people could count on their fingers how much stuff they actually owned, right? Yeah. I have, you know, 3 articles of clothing. I have, you know, 2 of this and 2 of that, and that's pretty much it. You know, I have like 15, 20 things. That's it.
Yeah.
I don't think any of us now could even forget count on you couldn't count in general how many things you own.
When they say the blessings of Allah Ta'ala cannot be counted, most people's possessions literally today cannot be counted. That's ridiculous. Like, how many things are in this house? It's unbelievable. It's unreal. Especially when you have, like, if you have a friend, let's say, that bothers you, that annoys you, right? You know those types of people that annoy you, but they're stuck with them in life. When they have a daughter, you should be celebrating. You go out there every time you visit them and you buy them little bracelet kit, little jewelry kit, right? In 2 days, the house will be littered with little beads, little wires, little things like this. Because plastic and stuff is cheap. Because of industrial movement, this stuff is just so cheap, right? It's meaningless. And I think it ruins childhoods even, because I had like a box of toys, a box. And then in there was a closet, there were some games, board games, and there was a box of toys. That toys had cars, He-Mans, and Transformers, and G.I. Joes.
Yeah.
Right? That box, believe it or not, my dad actually still has it in the closet, because that was my box of toys.
Right.
Right? There was a period of time where things got ridiculous. That's when toys started getting cheaper. But there was that initial box of toys. When you got a toy, you got a toy like on Eid.
Birthday,
Eid. Yeah. So I can remember, you know, those toys, and I sort of actually pass them down, right? But today, a kid gets a toy. That toy is like forgotten.
Immediately.
Before the next, you know, day passes, next week passes, right? And they're like sometimes really neat toys. Like a bottle top, you pull the thing and the top goes around, you know, whatever.
Yeah, top.
Beyblade.
Yeah, Beyblades and all that stuff. And those types of things, he just stopped playing with them last week.
The youngest here.
Right? So these types of toys, they would have been amused a kid in our generation for the whole weekend, every weekend, for like a year or two. But nowadays, it's meaningless.
So that's not just with toys. I mean, that's with anything from media to art to books to podcasts. Like, take our podcast, for example, right? I know the way I listen to podcasts, it's just one after the other, right?
Yeah.
You get one, and then the next one comes along. Then you get one, and the next one comes along. You don't even remember what was said in the last, you know, like, few podcasts.
That's why I actually don't personally attend, as a speaker, conferences, because I feel like the time there is spent is wasted. Let's say I give a great 10-minute, 15, 20-minute talk, let's say hypothetically. That's going to be drowned out by 10 other equally excellent talks.
Mm-hmm.
Like, there comes a point that these events, they're not going to invite some kind of person who's going to bore anyone. So everyone's going to be good.
Right.
Right? So, in fact, you know, like, your good statement is going to be drowned out by 10 other good statements. So the idea of the drown out, it's so pronounced these days. Yeah,
and that's why I forget where I heard this tip. It's that repetition is the key to memory, and it's the key to really anything, right?
Yeah.
And so even when it comes to like a lecture or a talk, a slightly mediocre talk is better in a private audience that you've actually taken notes in and you've heard a few times, rather than, you know, somewhere else where you hear this amazing talk over and over again. I have this book at home. It's called The Toothpaste Millionaire. I got it when I was like maybe in like sixth or seventh grade, and I still have it on my shelf. And I've read I remember when I was younger, I used to read it. You know, every few weeks I would be going through the book. It's only like 50 pages or something. That's about this kid who opens up a toothpaste factory and he becomes an entrepreneur and whatnot. But I remember reading this book over and over and over again because I didn't have that many access to that many books as a kid. I mean, so I was just going through that book, and I still remember it to this day. And it's something that's like, when it comes to entrepreneurial work, like it's something that inspires me to this day. Like, I mean, I've read a bunch of self-help books on, you know, how to start your own business and become your own, you know, entrepreneur and all that stuff. None of it has impacted me, but this stupid book called The Toothpaste Millionaire, which is probably very poor, mediocre writing anyway, written by an unknown author that nobody knows about, and it's like 50 pages. That's the one that stays with me.
When people were studying in Syria, and there came a time where everyone's going to Syria, someone asked Imam Zaid, what's the best book to study? He said, the one you finish. These people study so many different books, and they get this ride the wave. So there's a new sheikh, okay, let's ride that wave. Everyone's now studying mantiq, let's ride that wave. All of a sudden everyone's studying hadith, let's ride that wave. It's just the one you finish. And that's where less is more. One of the thrills I get every once in a while is going through the house with a garbage bag and just dumping, right? And if it's good, I'll take it out to the certain neighborhoods where they don't have anything, right? And they'll take anything. Literally, they are so miskeen that one time, one of the things that we dumped out of the masjid, the shoes that had been left there, there was one shoe which was a left chappal. The right one wasn't even found. It was a left, someone took it. Just the left chappal.
SubhanAllah.
I mean, so there are people not so far from us that are so miskeen. And we just have so much. So the idea of the empty room, I just crave the empty room, right? So I just take, put it in the garbage bag. It's all, and no mercy. Vicious. Yeah. No mercy. No sentimental value. Sentimental value, picture album. That's it. And sentimental value, some people are almost, their consumption is that. Oh, this is the pencil that someone gave me. Oh, this is the bracelet that grandma gave me. Grandma doesn't even remember giving it to you. She probably received it from someone else and was just given it back.
It was a re-gift.
It was a re-gift, right? this is the shirt that so-and-so gave me. It's all just empty stuff, and it's just meaningless.
I have to say that I might have a controversial take in the middle of this at some point, maybe.
When do you not?
So, first of all, I agree with you. Empty space, an open room with nothing in it. This is the perfect environment for a normal human being, right? You don't need a lot of artifacts on the walls. You don't need a lot of distractions. You don't need a lot of different patterns and colors. What you need is a space that reflects, you know, it gives you the ability to just think and be with Allah. I knew a brother really well who, before he got married, he had a one-bedroom apartment. In that apartment, he had a futon, so his couch and his bed, a milk crate with like a cloth over it to make it look like a table.
Okay.
That he had a little TV on, no cable, just antenna, and just to get the local news or whatever. A kitchen table with two chairs, a few plates, a couple pots to cook.
That's it.
And that's literally everything. And like a radio to play CDs or whatever. That's everything that he had in the house. This is a perfect environment. It's
beautiful. I actually love the idea of open space. It makes me feel good.
Yeah.
Whereas clutter, and the Egyptians have this habit that I think they took from the French Baroque style.
Just overdoing it. Giant furniture.
Yeah, giant furniture that's bigger than the human himself, right? There's more space in terms of volume. The couch takes up more space than the actual human being.
Yeah.
Beds that are huge.
I saw a bed. Wallahi, I saw a bed last week.
Yeah.
With a ladder. With two steps, like a step thing.
It's ridiculous. And how about if there's a corner, there's got to be a little vase. Look at all these gifts.
And everything has to be overly ornate. Nothing simple.
Excess. And that's what people don't realize. That's the Baroque style. That's what they did. every single inch has to have something on it. And when you have dinners or friends come over, they're going to bring you a gift. I want to tell my friends, don't bring me gifts. You want to bring me a gift? Bring me things that I actually need. This type of light bulb, right? So I don't have to replace them. Batteries, right? I'd much rather you give me that. Batteries, basic stuff. Don't give me, like, look, it's in the back here. A plate. What do you do with it? Okay, like a vase, right? I hate Mikasa. The whole company should be...
Well, one time, one of our we invited some good friends over for dinner.
Yeah,
they came. They brought like 3 pounds of chicken.
That's like a great gift
for your freezer.
That's here. A great gift.
That's like actually fresh, good chicken.
That's a good. That's a good.
It was gift, the best right? gift anybody's ever brought for dinner.
That's a great.
Don't bring me a pie.
Don't.
I already cooked. You don't have to add to the dinner. You gave me raw chicken that I can put in the freezer and have chicken for a few weeks. Sense. It's such a great
that's
gift.
A, way more I'm sense. Actually gonna. That's
it's a great gift.
That's a great gift.
It's a great gift.
And it's a very useful gift too.
Yeah. So, see, one of the things that you're talking about, and one of the things that, so here's the controversial take. I think that men, if men were men, this wouldn't be a problem.
100%. That's not controversial.
Like
not on this podcast.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. This is not something that comes to the male psyche naturally.
Which is what?
To want to like have a bunch of stuff and collect things. And I'm not saying that there's not men that are like that aren't like that. There are. But like that brother I'm talking about, everything changed when he got married because he got married. So now he had to have more furniture, obviously. Yeah. And you have to have more things. And you have to have a better TV. And you have to get a bigger place to live in.
Yeah.
And you have to... This is... If left to our own devices, men would live in a simple 4x4, right? With white walls.
Yeah.
And like one thing to sit on.
One thing that I'll take... Well, you know, the sunnah of the Prophet Sallallahu Alaihi Wasallam of space, right? So I'll make a trade-off. Space for stuff.
Yeah.
Right? Stuff... It's gone. And listen, here's the thing. What I do, here's a trick for the for people out there. Anyone out there, could be moms, could be dads, could be husbands. Take the thing, put it in the trunk of your car. Wait 6 weeks. Wait 2 days. Wait 3 days. I guarantee you no one's going to remember it. And at that point, 2 months pass. You didn't remember it. Tough luck. Mm-hmm. That's it. It's over. You didn't remember it, right? So if the value of it is so low to you that it's been missing off the shelf for 2 months... And you never thought about it. So
I think a lot of it, you know, not to psychoanalyze people, but I think a lot of it comes from anxiety and fear of future not having.
Mm.
Right? So like the other day, this just happened the other day. My wife, we were going through a box to throw some stuff away that was in the box. And there was a thing of shoelaces.
Yeah.
And my wife was like, do you want to keep these? And I said, no. Number one. I don't remember the last time that I changed shoelaces in a shoe. When's the last time you needed shoelaces? It's never happened in my adult life.
Yeah.
But fine. Suppose that weird emergency happens when I need shoelaces. Number one, those probably won't match. Number two, I won't remember where they're at.
That's true.
So like, just throw them out.
Yeah.
There's no way that I'm keeping those shoelaces just in case I ever need a shoelace for one of my shoes.
Yeah.
So where does it come into though? Like when you purchase something and then... Like, it has, like, the monetary value, right? Like, how do you just throw it out?
I don't throw it out. I take it to the Walgreens.
Uh-huh.
And across the... Well, it's not the Walgreens. It's the Walgreens is there. But it's, area, the, it's the park.
Mm-hmm.
You know that park in New Brunswick?
Yeah, we know.
Okay. And there's Sam's Chicken across. It's a beautiful park, actually. Mm-hmm. They take care of it very well. And there's also... There's homes. There's different streets. There's a lot... It's a really busy area. I don't throw the stuff out. I put it in the garbage bag. I put it in the trunk. Once that trunk fills up or the garbage bag fills up, I drive in there 24 hours a day. There are human beings there.
Mm-hmm.
24 hours, unless it's raining or snowing. I take it. They now know. And this is the beauty of it. This is really what I wanted. I want them to associate our community of Muslims with benefit.
Mm-hmm.
Right? And that's just how the Prophet would want it. It's not some kind of cheap dawah trick. That's just how the Prophet would want Muslims to be like. We should be associated with people benefiting.
Yeah, if you're in a community, the people should benefit from your presence.
They should be if we disappeared, you know, there are some communities Muslims disappeared, nobody would even blink an eye. No one would miss any. No one would miss them.
The liquor store might close.
Yeah. So we go out there and we put the stuff.
That was a dark joke.
Yeah.
This is serious. Yeah. My brother-in-law lives in Brooklyn. It's legit.
Yeah. When Muslims come in, the liquor store closes out.
The right? Muslims own the liquor stores.
Oh, no. He meant the opposite way. The liquor store would
close. The Muslims disappear. There's no more liquor store in the neighborhood. Somebody else has to come in and open one now.
I didn't realize that. Well, that's no good.
No.
That's horrible. I thought you meant like the if too many Muslims come in, then the liquor store.
No, that would be a benefit.
Yeah. In England, they already did a study. I read that if the population of Muslims reaches 17%, the pubs suffer.
Because people don't go to the pubs.
Yeah, because they don't go to the pubs. Stays
that way. Yeah. That's because they got the hardcore folks over there.
Yeah, right, in England. They have those, yeah, who do things. So, but the thing is, you go out there to the greens, you put it out there, and now we're collecting from people. Like, we got boxes. Our runs slowly will take up more and more time because we just got so much stuff to unload, right? And it's a free giveaway. And it's just the disparity of haves and have-nots. We know that it's going to be there in the world, but this is how it should end up. It should be a constant bleeding from those whom Allah blessed to those whom Allah has tested. Yeah.
So in, another addition to that, and one of the things that I think philosophically can help you enact that, is something that I read from one of those minimalism, you know, getting rid of your stuff gurus, the very popular one, the Japanese lady.
Marie Kondo.
Marie Kondo. She said that the way you have to think about it is, if you have a thing that you're not using anymore, sure, you spent, say, $100 on it, and you're like, well, that's it's a $100 thing. I don't want to get rid of it because I spent $100 on it. But at the day that you no longer use it, you're not benefiting from, you've already spent that money. You're not getting it back. So you have to look at it like, okay, the use that I got from it or the joy that it gave me just to buy it. Maybe I never wore it. I bought a jacket and then I never wore it. And now I can't fit it or whatever. Or I don't, it's out of style. You got your $100 worth when you bought it. You got that excitement. You got that adrenaline rush. You got that, you know, serotonin hit, whatever it is. And it's over. You're not going to benefit from it anymore. And in fact, not only are you not benefiting from it, keeping it anymore, even though you paid for it, it's actually harming you because it's taking up space in your life and cluttering your environment. Yeah. So getting rid of it is the final step. You say, alhamdulillah, I got my use out of that $100 and now it's out of my life. Because otherwise, it's just garbage that you're collecting.
I have another technique, and I didn't read that book. A lot of people recommended me to read the book, but I never read that book. But I had my own trick. In the downstairs closet, you know, the jacket closet, which becomes, you know, a place of amassment of stuff. Mm-hmm. So, like, how am I going to fix the situation? I came up with a situation. Control the hangers. I declared. I control the hangers. Anything on the floor is going to the homeless, right? So, everyone gets an allotted number of hangers for the downstairs closet. If it's on the floor, it's gone. And that forces them to at least take it upstairs, right? And realize that they have so much, right?
Yeah.
So there's got to be limits on stuff because if you have a normal income, the amount of stuff that you can accumulate will literally, like, I had neighbors that were some older folks, and they were packing stuff. They were like pack rats. When they moved out, the people have to bring a container.
Yeah,
they had to rent a container just to dispose of stuff. A container. That's how much stuff they had. It's crazy. And here's the thing. I think I want to move away from actual stuff because consumption can be other things than just stuff.
Absolutely. One thing before we move on to other stuff in general is even the minimalist, like becoming minimalist is also like a form of consumption for people now, right? It's like a thing to like Marie Kondo your stuff, right?
Well, that's exactly what I want to bring up. And it's the hikam from the hikam of Ibn Atha. And when you read this book, you realize, subhanAllah, if all you need is a book in Aqidah, your manual of fiqh and the hikam of Ibn Atha. From the hikam of Ibn Atha is that he says there's something called Maidan and Nufus. And that is, and what he means by that, maybe the easier way to put it is the abode of creation. And that human beings, left to their own devices, will just obsess over, will suck on one type of creation or another.
Mm-hmm.
And he in another one, he uses the example of the donkey that is going around chasing his the barley that the donkey that they use to turn the mill.
Right.
So they put barley right in front of him, so he's chasing it. And he doesn't realize he's just going in a circle.
Right.
So likewise, we have this Maidan and Nufus, this arena of souls. It's just the attraction, our natural attraction to other created things. And we just go from one to another. And there are types of people who are maybe even in good things, right? So you'll see him get a law degree. All right, he worked so hard, got a law degree. Oh, it's good, benefits people. Next thing, get a real estate thingy, license. All right, now he sells homes. Next thing, he's a marathon runner. Right, so that's actually fine. It's an accomplishment to accomplishment to accomplishment. But guess what? They're all created things. Like, and he says, leave the created things and go to Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala. And that's where I think that this whole issue of consumption, this is where the way we have to think about it. Even like Moin just said, the idea of being a minimalist, it's still a created matter of the dunya. It's a matter of the world,
yeah.
Right? It's an obsession of the world. And Allah may test you with the opposite. What if your mom moves in with you and she's a pack rat, right? Now you can't be a minimalist, but Allah told you to take care of her and make her happy, right? So you, true freedom is going from obsessing over created things to obsessing to turning your attention to Allah Ta'ala.
Right.
Because you can be a minimalist in this. You can be a minimalist in, let's say, fat versus fitness. You know, no food and only, you know, basic food and no material. That itself has becomes
a thing. Yeah, that's a thing. Yeah.
So that's why consumption, we have to be careful. It's so many different things. And there's another hikmah, I think, not from Ibn Atta, but from someone else. Oh, it was Sufyan al-Thawri. Sufyan al-Thawri says, you'll see a man. He is a zahid in food. He's a zahid in living space. He's a zahid in clothes. Okay, he's a zahid in his wealth. But touch his reputation, right? And he'll kill you. Right? So he's not a zahid in the reputation that he's a zahid. You see that? How Sufyan al-Thawri was really perceptive that there are some people who have worshipped the concept of being a zahid.
Yeah, he needs some zuhud from his zuhud.
Exactly. Yeah. So he hasn't actually he's worshipped the act of worship.
Yeah.
Or he's worshipped the spiritual state, like the state of being a zahid, the state of never being involved in the dunya. It's a hal. We call it in Islam a hal. In tasawwuf, it's called a hal.
Yeah.
You don't worship the hal.
Yeah. Well, I mean, and the other thing is, if you're doing it for the sake of it, it could be a riya.
That's what it is.
And then you don't have that hal at all. You're just play acting.
That's what it is.
There's a trend of this even in the secular world, right? You see people all the time that take this consumption thing, take the minimalism thing. It's like, oh, I'm a minimalist to be a minimalist. I'm a vegan, you know, because I'm a vegan. They have no, it's like that, I think I sent you that video. This woman became, you know, she just became a meat eater. And like now she was like, oh, I've discovered the virtues of meat. And now she's no longer a vegan. So she wasn't even doing it for the animals. Like, she was just doing it for doing it.
Yeah.
And it's the same thing with things like, oh, you know, I don't watch TV. I just read books. Right. You know, I'm all about fitness. I work out, you know, twice a day. I do X, Y, and Z. But it's all just for the sake of the idea of whatever that thing is that you're doing. Even people, I mean, there's religious people like this, right? It's like, oh, I'm a student. I read X, Y, and Z books. I've devoured all of these texts.
Yeah. People chase identities all right. the time.
It's so, and oftentimes we do it without even knowing that we do it, right? It's like, oh, I've devoured all of these texts and I can recite to you, you know, from this text and this text and this text and this text. But it's like, is that, at what point is that even beneficial?
And we actually have too the idea amongst students of knowledge. It's not even a big, I don't think it's a big thing for Westerners, and it's not even a bad thing. But it does become an obsession, which is chasing asanid.
Yeah.
Right? Chasing isnads. And I've seen people who I thought were very mature people, right? Really like obsessing over asanid. Like, and the sign of it was that the discussion comes up in an inappropriate time. Like, there are, everyone else is sitting there. Nobody even has one senate, right? And they're having a discussion about all your asanid. And it's sort of like almost to the point that you're sort of making everyone else feel like trash.
Mm-hmm.
So that shows me that there is no balance there. Like, there's no perception that you're beyond you've gone too far, because you can't even perceive that other people are sort of bothered by it. It's almost like, in a spiritual sense, talking about money. In a material sense.
Absolutely. Same
thing. You can't go in front of certain people and say, oh, well, guess what? I just bought a Range Rover and then I'm going to trade that in. When it's done, I'm going to get the latest Mercedes, right? You don't talk about that in front of people, right? Likewise, some of Mesakin, they never had a chance to study. You don't go and carry on about how many Mashaykh you studied with when he can't even, there's not even a Shaykh within the same time zone as this guy, right? So,
also, collecting accolades and degrees and you know, different senads and different licenses to teach and just that.
Yeah.
This is just another type of thing. You know, I wish I could remember the name, and I can't, but it was one of the ulama of the Maliki school from the Maghrib. who his practice was to take a hadith, memorize it, and then go off and contemplate it.
Yeah.
And he would think about it, and he would see how he applied it to his life, find the places in his life where he can, you know, enact it if it was something of amal. And then he would come back and then take another hadith.
Yeah, that's it.
There's weeks between each one.
So I'm telling you, that's a beautiful way of doing knowledge.
And if he died with only having learned 100 hadith, he actually did something.
Yeah,
he acted upon it. Instead of being like, I memorized all these books.
Yeah.
And?
Yeah.
What are you doing besides memorizing books?
That reminds me how...
You sound like a computer.
Yes, how Abdullah ibn Umar took him, what was it, 16 years to memorize Surah Al-Baqarah? And someone said, how? He said, I would not memorize the next set of ayahs until I practiced the first one. Mm. So you literally have to drink it. It has to marinate. And deen has to marinate, right? Idea of compiling knowledge and reading so many books, deen or otherwise, right? Reading so many books, don't they all get washed away at some point? Mm. Like when you see people with a huge library, you've noticed, I don't even have a big library. In comparison to other people in the field who have stacks. You know what's his name? Out in UCLA? Professor Khalid Abul Fadl. The top story of his house has been transformed into stacks.
Oh, like literally like a library.
Library stacks. Like he went and bought library stacks.
He might have read all those books. He reads a lot.
Oh, he reads a lot.
He's not going back to them.
Yeah. I mean, so the thing is that to me, what's the value of something is never the thing itself. The value of it is the interaction of that thing with the real world.
Yeah.
That's if you think about really the benefit of something. It's interacting with it with the quote-unquote real world.
A great example of this that I can give is actually with people. I'm sure you guys all have friends like this. Do you have a friend who just has way too many friends and you know that you're not really important? There's people that you interact with where you know the interaction is just not valuable because of how many interactions they've they have on a daily basis, right? Where they have so many friends that you really just don't matter. Not that they don't genuinely, you know, like your friendship, but it's just they have so many that it's just invaluable, right? Yeah. I'm sure you guys know exactly what I'm talking about. I know everybody has a friend like this.
I know exactly what you're talking about. And there are some people who, as a phrase that they say, is, oh, it's so happy to see you. It's a bunch of nonsense, right? Because you never call, right? If I call, you never pick up, right? And, you know, everyone goes through a phase in their life when they're trying to make friends or they're impressed by somebody, especially when you're younger, right? You're impressed by someone. You're chasing after them, sort of. You feel that there's going to be some benefit by being around them. And they don't return your calls, right? They don't return your texts or emails or anything. But then when they see you, I guess they're embarrassed. So they say something really nice. But, you know, like, that's a total lie.
I feel this a lot, especially, you know, since I live in South Jersey where there's not that many Muslims around. Yeah. And so the few that are around, I mean, we know each other very, very well.
Yeah.
And so I know we used to joke around. It's like some guy was busy. It's like, you know, what were you busy with? Because you weren't with us and you don't seem to have any family problems going on. So, you know, what were you doing? Right. Whereas I know when I moved up here, it was very different, right? Interacting with people, because it's like you didn't get that same cozy feeling where it's like, okay, this person clearly has time for you and they're really around. And so I think the same can be applied when it comes to human beings. You can apply that to a lot of other things, right? It's there's value in the little things, right?
You know, in my defense, I actually, I'm the type of person that I genuinely like the people that I'm friends with, and I'm friendly with more. I get along with most people. There's maybe a handful, maybe six people, Muslims that I can think of that I generally don't like.
Yeah.
And that's my fault. I should work on that.
But six. I hope I'm not one of those.
No, you're not. You're not. Trust me, you would know. I would never even speak to you. But aside from those few, that handful of Muslims, I truly, genuinely feel like everyone is my brother. And some people you like more than others, right? Like I hang out with you guys. I actually come. This is a big deal for me to come out and actually be in person with people. I don't do that.
Yeah.
I tend to not socialize with other people like that. Not because I'm not a social person. In fact, the opposite. You know, you put me in the room, I walk around, I circle, I say salam to everybody. I sit down, I ask about their families. But it is genuine. But yeah, you might call me and I'm not going to want to hang out with.
when I made the statement that, you know, I definitely don't think it's not genuine. right? Well, the people that I'm talking about, I think they're actually very genuine. They're very sincere with the people that they meet, and I think they sincerely talk to and interact with people. However, they just do so much of it, yeah. right? Because of their profession or just, you know, the way that they are, that you know that your interaction is just not special. It's not, right? it's not that they don't genuinely try to do to meet with you, but it's like when you meet like a politician, for example.
Yeah.
They just meet so many people. It's just it's just not important, right? So my thought where I was going with that is I think the idea of consumption is where do we draw the line? So one thing that I had earlier in my notes is when it comes to food, for example.
Yeah.
You have like food critics, you have like luxury, you have like luxury eating. Where does Islam draw the line for those things? Is there a form of art that can be food? Is there a form of consumption that can be art?
Masterpiece kicked you.
Yeah. Well, I mean, the question is sort of like all the Urfi stuff. What are the pious Muslims who pray five times a day in the masjid? They're going to determine for that township or that region or that part of the world, they'll determine the norm, right?
But what do you do in, like, we live in almost like a global monoculture.
In terms of, for example, if you live in our area, let's say Central Jersey,
mm-hmm.
okay, which I know Alex doesn't think is a thing, but it's not a thing. He thinks it's an invalid statement by the governor, but it actually is by Urf.
That would be like the first correct thing he ever said. Yeah,
but there's limits. There's going to be a clear, you're going to, by going around to the different masajid, you'll get an idea where Muslims, pious praying Muslims, feel that something is too much or too little.
So eat a lot of sweets.
Wait, you think so? I don't know if I agree with that.
Why not?
Because
there's definitely going to be you're gonna find extremes. You're gonna if you spend 10 years, let's mm-hmm. say from a kid is 10 years old till he's 20 years old, he's gonna go to weddings, funerals, what you guys call davets,
yeah,
right,
yeah.
Davos, invitations basically.
Davots.
Okay.
Davot.
you have those invitations. He's gonna go to his friends' homes from high school and college. You're just by default going to get an idea of where the pretty rich people are at, where the pretty not rich people are at, and where everyone else is in the middle. So just by living, you get an idea of where the bookends are. And what is the balance? Balance is avoiding both extremes. That's it. Mm-hmm. So you really need to know the extremes.
But do we in the modern world already live at an extreme?
But that doesn't make a difference. We're not doing a historical comparison. You don't have to be balanced across the centuries.
Yeah.
That's not balance. So balance, like, is now.
Is your question like, what is the halal haram limits of that Islam sets for consumption, say of food? Like, sure. what is beyond the bounds?
Sure.
I mean, it's pretty open, right?
For food?
Yeah.
It's pretty open, I think. I mean,
you could eat a whole sheep every day if you want.
There's a difference between eating a whole sheep every day that you slaughtered versus going to, like, you know, Ruth's Steakhouse in Philly and you know.
Sorry, well, I mean, I just know
Philly.
Halal,
I just know Philly references.
I mean, like, not in the books of fiqh, there isn't, right? Like, you eat within your means, eat so that you don't harm your health, and other than that, it's up to you. You know, there's difference between what is halal and haram, and what's maybe spiritually better for you. Whatever angle you're taking for your fitness or for your nutrition, or you might have a medical need. But in terms of halal and haram, as long as the animal is slaughtered correctly, and man, it's basically
I mean, you're gonna have that's the fiqh of it, and all these things are why the mashayikh say tariqatuna as-suhba. Our path is suhba, because the spiritual path is really, in fact, different in these regards.
Mm-hmm.
Every century, every decade, right? There is a time where, you know, if you had certain amount of entertainment, or, you know, in a day or in a week, was considered you're a ghafil, right? Today, if you're doing that type of entertainment and it's halal, you're a salih, because you're not doing like pornography, right?
Right.
Now think about this: if you had a bunch of 17-year-old kids, and they prayed Isha in the masjid, then they went home. And they watched like a movie that did not have any skin in it. And played video games, okay? And then fooled around and ate chips all night and then went back to Fajr for the masjid, to the masjid to pray. And then went to sleep. What would you call those kids today?
The best kids we would know. Yeah, yeah.
What would those kids be called in the 70s?
No, total weirdos.
Yeah, right? Total like
burnouts.
Right?
Like you'd be like, what? Yeah. Are you smoking dope?
Exactly. Right. So that same type of same thing transported 33 decades. That's why there is no point in these trans-century, you know, continental comparisons with ourselves. There's no point. So that's why tariqatun as-sohba. How do we know where's the basic good and bad? Is by being around other people.
Okay, so let's take away the historical comparison.
Yeah.
If I were to ask you, how many pairs of shoes should a man own? That can differ across this table. Okay. I can say
it's,
three.
It's going to differ, right? It is. Let me tell you what. I'm going to tell you he should have wedding shoes. Wedding slash...
What are wedding shoes?
Shiny, nice, shiny shoes. Okay. Right? He should have the type of shoes that he could wear with like Dockers type pants and with jeans. That are nice shoes. You know when you wear a blazer with jeans?
Mm-hmm.
And those shoes.
Okay, so that's two.
That's two. He should have a pair. He could have a pair of sneakers if he wants. Nice sneakers and work sneakers.
So that's three. That's four.
So the nice sneaker that you could wear those sneakers with the jeans and the blazer. And then you have your work sneaker that you're going to do gardening. You're going to do sports. And then
that's five.
That's four shoes. No, four.
Okay, four. What about like sandals or...
And then, okay, if you're going to have sandals, they're fine. You're going to have two types of sandals. The sandals for the house, the 2 cent ship-ships that you're going to get from Target, right? And then you're going to have your fancy sandals that you'll wear with a thobe.
Okay, so let's say that's six.
Just 5.5. Because those 2 cent sandals that you know, those 2 cents bathroom wudu sandal type of thing, that's half.
So let's say you're at six, right? Fine, you have four people in the house. That's only men. I didn't count women. Let's say you have four people in the house. That's already 24 pairs of shoes for four people.
The women have a different situation on shoes, though.
By the way,
I'm just throwing out numbers. Yeah, I'm not saying anything, right? So,
when it comes to shoes, this is a top. Shoes are probably more important than the rest of your outfit.
Yeah.
At least in modern clothing,
you wear them every day,
right? So you have to have a nice pair of, like, so the wedding shoes, like dress shoes that you can wear with a suit.
Yeah.
Something
yeah.
that you would wear to a job interview if you were going to court or something like that. So you need a pair of those in black and in brown.
Okay. You're right about that. And that's exactly why I cut out all the brown.
I know.
From my
your
closet,
district is black and white.
Then, that means two belts, two socks, two shoes, right?
Yeah. Then you need the more casual shoe. You also need those in each
black
color.
And brown.
Yeah. So that's four.
Right there.
And right now you're just on shoes. Then you need, so the sandals, will throw in one or two of those.
Yeah.
You have to probably have three different types of sneakers, minimum. Because you have some that you have to do athletic stuff in.
Athletic stuff.
Some are that just for wearing like casually with like pants or jeans or whatever. True, right? And then the dirty ones that you do for whatever.
For work, okay.
Then you're going to need boots for the winter.
I forgot about boots.
I do not own a pair of boots.
Yeah, you need boots to shovel the snow. How are you going to shovel the snow?
Yeah, you need boots, winter boots. You also need...
what?
How are you gonna shovel the snow? You're not. What are you
wearing? Shoes
in the six other pair of shoes that you own.
No. What if you're gonna get 3 inches all in your ankles? Of snow. You have to get those Walmart boots. You get them once in your life. It's like $25. Literally 5 inches of rubber.
Yeah, steel toe.
You know, it's like 5 inches of rubber. And
they're
then
pull-ons.
A huge boot.
Yeah.
You don't even have to tie them. They're so high.
Yeah.
And they're so warm too.
Yeah.
You buy that once for your life.
So you've now seen the problem here.
Yep.
You're also going to need some hunting shoes, some hunting boots, because you're going, whatever, hiking.
Why can't the other boots work for the hunting?
Because they're not comfortable for walking miles in. You need stuff that you comfortably can walk around in the woods and climb over, you know, and trees and stuff, and hills and mud.
Well, why couldn't those boots just be used for the snow?
Or is this a different type of boot, man?
The snow boots.
By the way, if you really want to get into it, I have spring-summer woods boots. And winter wood. And neither one of those are used for shoveling snow, nor the ones that I'm wearing right now do I use for shoveling snow. So I'm personally probably at like that I wear in rotation. There's stuff I have to throw out, but that I wear in rotation at least 15.
Okay. But you've identified each function.
And I'm not even one of those guys.
Yeah.
I'm like a regular guy, yeah. But 15.
That's true. Now,
this is the same dude that actually owns hunting boots. So, I mean, that's...
Well, here's the thing.
Going in the woods.
No. I'm saying that this is as a compliment. Like
the brown and black thing was a big deal for me.
Yeah.
It was a big deal. I loathed... Once I discovered... And by the way, for a long time, I never knew anything about clothes.
I would have stuck with brown instead of the black shoes. Oh, yeah. They're more versatile.
See, when I was in my study phase, I didn't know anything about anything. I really had no clue about fashion until someone once told me, listen, the socks, the shoes, the belts have to be one color. You know that I like learned that? It's not something that I learned that like middle of life, like maybe when I was 25 or something.
And the watch.
Oh, and the watch. Could you believe that? I never had a clue. I would put on anything that was called clothes. I just put it on my body, right? And
mashallah.
But then when I discovered this, and I think it was Osama Cannon one time. We were in a hotel. We were in an elevator. And he was going around for his Zaytuna Institute doing dawah. And he was, actually it was Talif already. And he looked at me and he just shook his head, man.
He always dressed nice.
Yeah, he always dressed nice, right? Mashallah. So, and may Allah heal him. From his sickness. But once I learned that became a big headache. Huge headache. To the point I said, I can't do this. I'm not doing this anymore. I'm not taking 10 minutes to get dressed. All the pants, one color. All the shirts, one color. All the belts, one color. All the socks, one color. All the shoes, one color. Right? And my dad, he got me to get involved with gray. Because my dad lives in Toms River, which is right in front of Lakewood. Right under Lakewood. Lakewood has a bigger population of rabbinical schools than Israel.
America and Israel are the same number, 6.
Yeah.
So he didn't want you wearing a black suit with a white shirt.
Yeah, so every time I'd wear my black blazer with a white shirt and black pants, like most people here wouldn't think twice about it, but he's very conscious of it because every day he's seeing them, right? Yeah. And he's like, no, you look like a Hasidic Jew. Right, and I was just laughing off. So he got me aware of that. Then I said, "All right, I got to stick some gray in there somewhere, just to keep it within the scheme, but to avoid the." And the thing is, this is not about one of these fashionista type of people who are annoying. It's about efficiency. Mm-hmm. I'm not taking 10 minutes to find my clothes in the morning, right? I'm literally picking out whatever's clean from one shelf, the other shelf, and the other drawer. It takes me literally 60 seconds to pick out the clothes every morning.
I've done the same thing with my work, for work clothes only.
Yeah.
It's black shoes every day.
Yeah.
And the only colors I wear are gray and blue and white.
Yeah.
Because you can match those around in any works.
Yeah.
So, Mashoud, you're a college student. I'd like to hear your thoughts on the ridiculousness.
I was trying to. I don't know. I was trying to stay back on the shoes because I mean I went through a phase because I guess like 3 years out of high school is like not that long ago, so I was a collector of Jordans. It was expensive nonetheless, right? And then like when you go into like conversations of the Masakin and it just hurts like internally, because like you just have so much stuff, and then you see the value. That's why I was so hooked on like the value of those things that I bought, and now it's just getting personal. It's like the things that I bought, like will that value kind of like stay there, you know? And then it also goes into like being like a simple person. Like I have red Jordans, I have the blue Jordans, and then I have the white ones, and then the black ones. So like every outfit has to match, and that was the phase that I was going through. Like now I'm wearing my gym shoes, like, you know what I mean? Like it just doesn't.
Hey, listen, for some people who have little things like that, if you're doing, you're living well otherwise,
yeah,
I don't want to go to an extreme and say like this stuff is like you're like a, you know, don't deserve to exist type.
No. Exactly.
It's like if someone's given their sadaqah, gives a I think collecting yachts and collecting certain watches that are $5,000, that's where you're getting to a ridiculous level.
Yeah,
But wait, why is that ridiculous?
What's that?
Why is collecting a yacht or...
Because it's Arfi. Because for us, we consider it ridiculous.
It depends on your income level and stuff like that, right?
Yeah, the reaction to it, in a group, if you were to go and we were to have, let's say, 15 guys that we all know, and you were to say, I have 5 Jordans. That's not really a big deal. But if you were to say, I have 5 watches, each watch costs $5,000, we'd say, like, bro, that's absurd.
There's people that we know and we see regularly we're friends with that have, like,
would 5. Would they say it?
Yeah,
they would be embarrassed.
When they get around the other guys that also have Rolexes and Invictus and stuff, they start talking about
it. Oh, there's a group.
Of yes. course. Yeah. There's.
They're probably all in one field.
Yeah, I mean, that's why. That's why.
And it has nothing to do with watches.
Yeah.
But it, mashallah, Allah has blessed them with a lot of wealth.
This is why, actually, believe it or not, I was thinking the other day about the dictum of tariqatuna suhba. What suhba is the path. The path is suhba with people of taqwa. And where are people of taqwa? In the masjid, which is a public space, right? And their people of taqwa are all types of people. It actually pulls you out of this idea of hanging out with the people of your profession. This is actually a very bad, it has a lot of negative impacts.
Mm-hmm.
Like doctors with doctors, lawyers with lawyers, even let's say mashayikh with mashayikh, imams with imams. This has a really negative impact because your vision of priorities becomes totally skewed, of reality becomes totally skewed, right? Whereas when your sahba is regular people of the mosque, you're going to have the millionaire and you're going to have everyone else and you're going to have the miskeen who is like the ward of the community because we all have to take care of him. Because he'll never pick himself up. And we accept that. Khalas, we'll take care of him. Mm-hmm. And we have those people, by the way. Right? Sheikh Nasser knows them all. He's got his list of guys, some very old, some not. We just know they will never pull it together. And we've come to realize that and accept it. And khalas, that's how the community gets their mm-hmm. sins forgiven from them, by taking care of this family. Mm-hmm. That gives you a perspective, right? And what you can't say there is probably most... resembles reality than what you can or can't say with a group of surgeons or a group of lawyers or whatever.
That's actually true.
Yeah.
For Mashun, I just have you're not married, right?
No.
All right. So this is off topic but on topic.
Uh-huh.
This is actually it's 100% on topic.
Yeah.
Dress nice. Buy expensive clothes that you can if you can afford it. Buy nice stuff and get opinions from like your cousins and your sisters and if you have young aunties. Right, trust me. It's a huge benefit. It's going to be a huge benefit to your life. Definitely. As you walk into the next phase.
Mental health. So much of mental health is ironing your clothes, mm-hmm. right? Mm-hmm. And doing your bed in the morning and cleaning your room and your kitchen. It actually produces a change in a person's mental situation and emotional situation when they're clean. And I always look at it like this. Think about this. Here we are in a non-Muslim land. We got all this hill in front of us and all this fitan in front of us. I mean, for someone to spend for a Muslim to spend a little bit more than usual on appearance, he's already dealing with so much nonsense. Cut him some slack.
Yeah, right? And it's also sunnah.
And it's also a sunnah too. So the Prophet ﷺ was never seen except that he looked well. Like he never looked unkempt. And this is, some people say this is the reason why Uwais al-Qarni never made it to become a Sahabi. They said that so that his path is not considered a sunnah. Because if he was a Sahabi, his path of living homeless, eating from the garbage, that's literally how he lived. Never marrying, never settling down, always just on the road and being homeless like that is not one of our sunnah, right? And that's one of the wisdoms some people say he never became a Sahabi. Because you do have those people in the ummah, but you shouldn't try to be like that.
The nafs is very attracted to that sometimes.
Oh, the nafs can be attracted. And we have our own Uwais al-Qarni in our community, right? Like, you know who it is. Mm. We have an old man who is our Uwais al-Qarni. He didn't do it by design. The life jammed him into that lifestyle. And he lives like that. And he pops up, you know, every few months. And he disappears every few months, right? And he is the barakah of the community and the ward of the community. And like that's his thing, right? That's how he lives. And if you ask him, he never planned it. He probably doesn't even know Uwais al-Qarni and what his story is like.
Such a good guy, though.
Such an amazing man. Full of barakah.
Yeah. Yeah. So in terms of, like, there were the phases specifically with me, like, going to... at first I went to community college. And then, like, just going to community college, it was more like... It wasn't really the friendships, I would say. It was more of just, like, getting through that to go to the university life. But within the community college life, I went through a phase, and I feel like a lot of college students might connect, where it was kind of, you were going towards, because it was a first college experience, you're going towards that life where Islam is really not present, right? And then, like, you're trying to consume all this knowledge and all this information about the exact opposite lifestyle, right? Because everyone that you're going to make friends in terms of, right, you're going to make that, they're just going to be usually not Muslim. And then when you try to connect to the MSA, that's just an entirely different story. And then with me specifically, how I got over that was trying to look better, right? Like trying to like feel better by just like appearance wise, right? Like, you know, oiling my beard. Like that was a thing that I'm very nice. Like I like to have like oil and like a comb my beard just for the personal kind of, it helps your mindset and it helps you like present yourself as a Muslim. Totally. Like, you know, because and like now specifically because I do like I do daily reminders on Instagram, right? Like I do just like Islamic reminders, and it just helps like with me, like I guess if you're in a public eye, right? It just helps when you're looking better and you know you're known as the Muslim. Yeah. Not that you want to look like that, but you're just known as the Muslim. So that's just
there's so much negative PR though that, you know, reverse. Yeah. Of that would not harm us at all.
Of course.
Yeah, exactly.
I'm telling you, I had a friend who was unemployed in England and he was so miserable. Just couldn't get a job. So he was so depressed. I said, man, what are you going to do? He's like, so one day I saw him getting dressed up. Right? I said, oh, you got an interview? He said, no, I'm so down. And in France, a trick is you get dressed up, you trim your beard, you shave properly, you get a haircut, and you just walk in the streets. And that's how you pick yourself up. Because people actually look at you like you're important, right? And you start feeling better about yourself.
Yeah. That was one of the parts of Elijah Muhammad's program was you have to look clean and neat and dress the part.
Oh, you have to totally.
To combat the negative stereotypes and propaganda. So Sheikh, let's outline some topics on consumption.
Okay.
So like food, what are the parameters?
Food, three meals a day. If you want to talk about it, because the ulama have spoken on this.
Yes.
They said the prophets eat once a day, if that. The Salihin eat twice a day. The rest of people and animals eat three times a day.
So that's max. And has to be halal meat.
It's got to be halal meat. It's
not even but there's still people today, 2020, eating 100% right.
And someone asked me, what exactly is halal meat the other day in the masjid that's been praying with us for years, right? So they didn't realize that this is not a sunnah, it's not a mandub, it's not wara. The animal must be slaughtered properly with the neck, right? Yes. By the neck. The two blood vessels and different, you know, cut by the neck, okay? And the name of Allah mentioned on it. And you may eat kosher. You can consume kosher food. It's halal for us to do that, to cook kosher meat. So that's a necessity.
No Popeye's chicken sandwich.
Popeye's chicken sandwich, which is not halal?
Yeah. It's out. Okay.
Forget it. It's not tayyib either.
Yeah, it's not.
Yeah.
All right. Clothing. It has to do with your amount of risk that you have.
Clothing, that's a good question. I mean, what would your answer be on clothing? Because I would say a closet. That's it. What do you need?
Well, no, I mean in terms of like the level of clothing, right?
Yeah.
So like I always return to the narration from Omar radiallahu anhu when he saw the man, he was dirty, he tried to give him money.
Yeah.
And he said, no, I have money. He said, well then spend it on your clothes and dress nice. Or Imam Malik, who
always looked nice.
No, israf in smelling good and dressing nice.
Oh, he said that. Subhanallah.
Yeah.
The smell, we know the Prophet ﷺ said there's no israf in it. Now, I didn't know Malik extended that to clothes because Malik was always sharply dressed for a reason.
I may be interpolating. Maybe it was just he was quoting the Prophet ﷺ on the scent. So he always dressed very nice.
He always dressed nicely. And he said that we're in a time where the people respect the emirs more than the imams. So he actually was combating that, right? So imagine what it is today, right? I think people should dress their profession. Surgeons, if you're a surgeon and you're going to cut me up, I hope you're coming in a luxury car, right? Because if you're coming in like a Honda and you're wearing Dockers, I'm wondering why you're not more successful, right? And you're going to cut me up. If you're a trial lawyer, you're a gangster, basically. You should be dressed in an intimidating way. You should come up reflecting that. If you're a real estate agent, we know that real estate agents have to have a luxury car. They actually write it off as a part of their job, as a tax deduction, right? So you should dress your role. Now, if you're a sheikh in the masjid, there is something weird about a sheikh in the masjid coming up in some kind of like Maserati. It just doesn't, it's not haram, it just doesn't fit the what we perceive.
Even if, right? Like say you come from wealth,
you know, maybe not. I mean, the thing is that when you deal with people, it is sort of awkward, you know, that because his job function is a middle. He should be middle. He should not be poor because that may, he's needy. Mm-hmm. That means he might, you know, treat people better for, you know, for their charity or something. And he should not look so much that he intimidates the fuqara that are around him too. So I would say there's a middle level. Imams, the people of scholarship should be in the middle.
So I'm going to disagree on a couple of things. Okay. And not just disagreeing for myself, because I know this is a really, you know, personal, like this thing could differ person to person.
Yeah, it's a matter of right.
And it's also a matter of, you know, somebody listening from, you know, Australia might have a completely different take on this than someone listening from New York City or someone listening from Kansas, right? And so, for example, I would have no issue with, you know, my surgeon walking in a Prius and Dockers. I would have no issue with that as long as, you know, that person is. So like I said, that's,
if he wants an electric vehicle, he should at least be a Tesla.
No, so that's person to person, right? Like, that wouldn't bother me at all. I'd be like, okay, does he have the credentials? How has he done in the past surgeries? Like, is he successful in his profession? If he chooses not to buy a Tesla Roadster, that's cool with me. Like, you know, that's,
I believe, I don't know, maybe my thinking is bizarre. If he's cheapo on his pants, he might be cheapo in the room. Like, I don't want to use too many bandages.
How do you know he's only? How do you know he's cheap? Why are you?
He's wearing like cheap. Like, if he looks like he shops at Kohl's.
Listen,
he's a surgeon.
If you're pulling $15,000 a month, right?
That's nothing.
That's nothing. Right?
Even more than that.
They're pulling more than that, right? Mm-hmm. If he's pulling $20,000 and $25,000 a month, and you're buying pants, and you choose the $29.99 pant over the $59.99 pant, there's something wrong in your head. If that $30 matters to you that much, right? When you're pulling $25,000.
I'm just saying, like, that would, like, because I see it, like, I'm in tech, right? And yeah. I see it all the time. Like, I see my VP who's like,
So this is what the Orfi thing, right? So the next category I was going to say when you were saying doctor and is IT. If you work in IT, you have to wear a t-shirt.
You right. actually have to wear
Vans
down. You have to go down.
You have to. Right? You might not cut your hair on a regular schedule.
This is how I go into work, and I'm probably like well dressed for my office.
But you all, but you emphasize that you're UX or whatever it's called.
No, I'm not. Not UIX anymore.
Or whatever. Not IT.
I'm software now.
IT to me is a Toyota or a Honda. Okay.
Because they're Daisy.
New Balance, right? Yes. New Balance sneaker, like Lee jeans or Wrangler jeans.
Yeah, right. these are
and
guys.
He's an ICNA member.
if you're in IT, even if you're like a white
best
dude, or
joke
even
so
if
far.
You're a white guy or a black guy or whatever, and you're in IT or you're in tech somehow, yeah, you're probably not. You don't care. Your mind is on other things, so you don't really look at the clothes that you wear, and you might not even match your outfits, and you're probably somewhere on the spectrum anyway.
Yeah,
and right? I can tell you,
and he doesn't deal with a customer, right?
No,
face to face. Now, here's the thing about the surgeon. That surgeon's going to hospital events. He's going to medical conferences, and he's seeing his peers. By nature, of human nature, you need to be similar to your peers.
When that guy has 5 Rolexes, I'm not even mad at him.
Oh, it's not even an issue. Because think about this. If this guy goes to medical conferences, he goes to other invitations with his medical group, he goes to a hospital party at the end of the year, and he sees all these people with all these that norm of medical, standard of living, and he still goes against the grain that much to wear Dockers and drive a Prius. He has a problem. He's a contrarian, right? Yeah. He has an issue, and I'm not going to go and investigate him anymore to cut up my body, all right, and open me up.
Something's wrong. You're probably. I mean, this I can agree with. It's. And one thing you brought up, like, for example, I work in engineering now, right? And I know before I used to work in product management, and I see the stark differences in, one, my coworkers, but also in myself as my role has, you know, now that I work on the engineering side, it's like I don't care anymore because I don't talk to people anymore, right? I do my own thing. I come into work and I'll see you later. Yeah. And it's interesting because that also influences my worldview about other people. So it's like it's Urfi, it's also your own profession. Like I know a doctor is probably judging all tech people, like, oh, these people don't dress well. They're always like, I know Alex probably judges all tech people. And
I don't. I mean, not incorrectly anyway.
So that was clothing. So let's say vehicles.
Wait, but before we get to it, can I give you one more thing in the
corner?
So take an academic, a college professor. They should dress nice. They should look nice. But you don't want him coming in like a gray suit that has a little bit too much sheen to it, with a really sharp tie. something really weird nice shoes.
Yeah. That's true.
And his hair is well coiffed. You're gonna be like, is this guy a professor or is he a lawyer or a salesman? What's going on here? So like, even on the small details, it makes a difference.
There's a congruous thing there. Yeah. Now here's the thing: if you have a lawyer, if you're going to lawyers and you're signing off to get a house or whatever, and that lawyer is not well kept, you can tell that like his hair is not done right. Hair, that's a sign of lack of care about details.
Yeah.
Now what about if he doesn't care about details on his hair or his suit or his office? How do I know he kept the care of the details in my contract? He
probably didn't.
So there is a reason when a subconscious reason of why these two things sort of are congruous or incongruous. Like Alex said, when if you have a professor in school, you actually want him to be a mad scientist look. That's culturally what we've come to expect, but there's a reason for that.
Or wearing like tweed and corduroy.
Yeah,
and
that wool. He's so engrossed in his fields that, in terms of the mad scientist type, so engrossed in his fields that he's thinking so much that he can't have time to think about whether to push or to pull the door or how to comb his hair. That's for the mad scientist. Now, the type of literature guys, it's a guild. They dress a certain way. By him dressing that way, I get the feeling that he's part of that guild.
Yeah.
Every profession, every field has its own look to it, right? And this is something that is a bid'ah in our world. It's become a norm.
Yeah.
In the time of the Prophet ﷺ, the clothes you went to war with, the clothes you gave the khutbah with, the clothes you bought and sold with, the clothes you heard the sheep with is one garment. That's their life, but we don't compare to
bid'ah hasanah though.
Yeah, it's fine. Or, but it's going to be
bid'ah hasanah. Or it's mubah at least.
It's at least mubah. Yeah.
I think this is one topic that, one area of the idea of consumption that I think Dr. Shethi brought up, and I think Dr. Shethi has brought this up not just with consumption but other topics as well, is you can't live in this like fairy tale past of, you know, this is what the people of old were like and this is what we need to be like today, because the world changes. Islamism is a adaptive religion that changes, you know, with the people and the times, and that's one of the great positives of our deen and our usul and our fiqh, right?
I'm going to trigger a lot of Hanafis and even some Malikis with this.
Okay.
There is something about congruity in your appearance that has a real, it's really important. Mm-hmm. It's really necessary, and it affects your dawah and it affects the way that you present the deen to people in life. If you're going to have long hair and a big beard, then dress in flowy clothes. Right, you should be wearing thobes and shalwar kameez and stuff like that. If you have like a real big beard and you have like you keep your hair long, it doesn't look good with a suit. Doesn't look good with like a shiny long sleeve T-shirt that people wear to a club. Like it looks ridiculous. By the same token, if you're like neatly trimmed and well coiffed and you're walking around with a thobe all the time, like grow your beard a little bit, maybe let your hair grow. Like you the things, the two things have to match.
Yeah, the congruous stuff.
Because if not, you look like you're wearing a costume.
Yeah, no, it looks like you're confused. You're between civilizations, right? Like you're of a civilization living in another civilization.
Imshim Muhammad Yaqubi, when he was in MBIC a few years ago, he said that one of the things that he dislikes to see is people taking Islamic clothes from different cultures and mixing them.
Yeah, it's actually a pet peeve too of mine.
Yeah.
Like the Maghribi thobe with a Palestinian scarf.
Yeah.
It's like, you know, when you watch old 90s movies where they're showing the Arabs or the Muslims, and they clearly, costume designer was not hired from the right department.
He's wearing shalwar kameez with the Palestinian scarf with the Afghan hat.
Yeah, exactly.
Or a shalwar kameez with the blazer. That is my absolute pet peeve.
I think that's become a thing, though, in Jordan and Pakistan, the Arab
thing.
Clothes with the blazer. But it's a thing for a different meaning. It's sort of like we've accepted the colonization type of thing. It's like the colonization is in us now. It's flowing in our blood.
It's like the pointed collar on a thobe.
Yeah.
What are you wearing, a tie with that? Why would you have that collar on?
Well, how about the one where I think it was one with Salah ad-Din and Orlando Bloom?
Yeah. I know what that's called. Kingdom of Heaven.
Yeah. So what was that, 2001 or something like that, 2002? So in that, they clearly filmed it in Morocco. You know they filmed it in Morocco. Mm-hmm. All the extras are wear Moroccan clothes. The palaces all have Moroccan symbols of the Almoravid dynasty, yeah. Right? That La Ghalib illallah. And it's almost like you have to actually suspend any sense of history, if you know any art history, or any sense of what kind of geometric designs fit with what civilization, to pretend that you're in Palestine for that movie.
And anybody that doesn't have a familiarity with that Middle Eastern history, it's like having something set in like 18th century England, yeah. Right? Or 19th century England, right? Industrial Revolution time, but they're all dressed like French people, yeah. During the 1600s.
Yeah, exactly.
Like, what do you... No. and then the writing is in French.
Yeah. Or it's like someone with the French socks, you know, those long French socks,
the sans culottes.
Yeah, and a tie. So he went from continent to different centuries, different continents.
So yeah, there's an importance to the congruity of your look. If you got to go all in.
Yeah, the congruity of the look is something that sort of reflects a type of wholesomeness of person, and we're
in authenticity. You're not pretending.
Too. Yeah, and here's the thing: is that we're a people now. Islam is comes to civilizations. There's no specific thing called Islamic culture, mm-hmm. Right? There are cultures, and Islam comes to that culture and is their religion, right? And then we'll tweak a few things here and there. So, for example, in our Western culture, one thing that we would tweak is the tight pants for men. It's makruh.
Nah.
If it's skin tight, it's haram. Because coverage, the meaning of coverage has two conditions. La yashif wa la yasif, which means it's not transparent and it's not form-fitting. If it's transparent or it's form-fitting, you aren't covered. Your salah is invalid. And even it's sinful to even go out into the public with those images or with that dress.
And wear a shirt that's not like when you make sujood, it doesn't it's become a midriff shirt.
Yeah,
yeah. Don't show me your back.
Yeah, there was a sheikh who was really funny, Palestinian sheikh, that he used to say to all the brothers in the masjid, "Please, your shirts are coming up, right?" And he said, "From now on, every time if you can't afford it, every time I see someone is back, I'm gonna put a nickel in there." I'm gonna put a nickel in the crack, right? So since you gave me a slot and you apparently you can't afford clothes, right? So I'm putting a nickel in there. And they actually made plumber's shirts for that. Because the other industry of field of people
that are on their hands and knees.
That are on their hands and knees and their back is showing all the time is plumbers. So there's a company by them called the plumber's shirt or whatever the company's called.
By the way, I'm going to offer a bit of practical advice to people who might find themselves in that situation.
Yeah, sorry, Moeen's mom is probably calling him.
When you're in Salah and you know that your shirt is maybe a little bit shorter, your pants don't stay up well, before you prostrate, pull your pants up, like if you're a man, grab your pants from the front by your pockets.
Yeah.
Pull them up on your leg.
Before sajda. Yeah.
And it'll sense. Keep it'll keep the pants from pulling down and the shirt from coming up.
Yeah.
It's just a simple little trick.
Yeah.
Wait, that's just like a trick. It's not like, okay, so for a long time, right, a lot of my I believe cousins and also, right, they thought it was like a condition of Salah to like do that, to like
pull your pants up
or like show your ankles or something.
And but just then, before sujood?
Yeah.
No, it's to keep your back from being exposed.
Yeah, it's to keep your pants from being pulled down.
Yeah.
I think people are, civilizations are what they are, and I take, you know, life to be what it is, and you're just going to adapt a few tweaks here and there. But you got to sort of not be ridiculous in the sense of that this issue of congruity. People should have a sense of how they're looking. This is not an artsy-fartsy thing or a superficial thing or you know something that should be pushed on the side. Especially now, you want to talk about going and doing da'wah, at least you got to be someone that I could look at. Wallahi al-Azim, there are some people, the Muslim himself, and I'm as a Muslim to a Muslim, I can't look at him. I can't look at him and enjoy what I'm looking at, right? Because it's so incongruous, it's so not caring, there was no attention given to it. Okay, that how are you supposed to do da'wah? And that's why one of the attributes of all prophets was that they were wasim, that they were, their faces did not have any blemish in it that would make people not want to look at. And I'm not even talking about looks. I'm saying in general, you should be able to be kept, well kept enough that people could look at you. And for youth, when we talk about youth acting up and being crazy, sometimes it's just like there's no self-esteem. They don't take care of themselves, and they're sloppy. So their mind is sloppy. Their life is out of order. It all starts with your own self. If you can't take care of your own self, then how are you going to take care of anything else in life?
So I'm not going to quote Mufti Niaz, but I remember him teaching us a principle oftentimes in fiqh, where there are many times in fiqh, and not just in fiqh, but also in matters of tasawwuf, where there isn't a clear-cut black and white rule. And if your nafs is pure, right, and your nafs is clean, he used to tell us that, you know, oftentimes in these situations, your nafs is the greatest mufti, right? That not everything in the deen has a rule, right? And oftentimes you come across a situation, for example, like we said, the number of shoes that a person should own. Like, I think we could all agree that probably depends on your profession, your background, your lifestyle. If your nafs is pure and clean, right, your nafs is your greatest mufti. When it comes to examples like this, when it comes to consumption of food, when it comes to consumption of entertainment, when it comes to consumption of other things, all of the guidelines that we have in our deen are set. Yeah. We know what those general guidelines and principles are. I think the hikam that you mentioned earlier, Dr. Shadi, which is, that you should go towards Allah in your consumption, right? When you take out the dunya and you go towards Allah, that's when, you know, everybody knows that in order to, for example, spread dawah, if you're going, you should look nice, right? But that is not in pursuit of the dunya. That is actually in pursuit of Allah, yeah. Right? So your goal in and of itself is different. And when your goal is Allah, it's not the consumption that's important. It's Allah that's important, right?
I think there's another hikmah that he says that if you view everything as coming from Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala, take what you want. That's Masha a beautiful Allah. Hikmah from Masha Ibn Al-Ta. If you view everything as a gift from Allah Ta'ala, take whatever you want, it won't harm you. Because when it goes away, you'll view it as Allah taking it away, right? At the same time, if that's truly how you view things, right? So that's where the idea of ask your heart, it does make sense in those situations. And when he says here in the hikmah that we go from creation to creation and go from creation to Allah, it's not precluding. It doesn't mean that a person is khalas, avoiding everything. No, you're still going to partake in stuff. It just won't affect you in a negative way. It'll be measured. It's coming and it's going will be equal to you at a certain point.
And that's not to say that your nafs can't be corrupted. That's why I'm not going to quote Mufti, but I remember learning this in one of his sessions that it goes with the saying that your nafs must be pure in order for that to happen. Right, yeah. So if you constantly pollute your nafs with, you know, terrible things, then obviously it's going to take you in the wrong direction.
Yeah, and also the whole thing of aesthetics and looking, put together. I think it should be put together in a very simple way, right? We shouldn't be getting to the point where, and some of our traditional circles, it's excessive in the ornamentation and the sort of dilettante type of approach to things, like
wearing like four scarves.
Yeah, it's like you four scarves, a special type of glasses, a really unique weirdo Where's Waldo cap type of thing, and then beads that are very fragile.
I've seen the Where's right? Waldo cap.
And I like things to be a bit more Spartan than that. Yeah. Like I like the thing to be, you know, if you're gonna wear a jacket, like less stuff. But nice, and durable too. Durable. Yes, yes. Not. I don't like the look of anything that is fragile. You know what? Like clothes can be so fragile. Like I have that one Moroccan thobe that I wore on Eid. I only wear it to Eid. As soon as I get home, I take it off right away. It's so nice that it's so fragile. It actually says to me. It says it's like it's sort of like an expression of the peak of society that has produced the finest ornate things. But they are so fragile that they're at the end of society, right? They're at their
end. So this is like a few weeks ago at the mini mullet after the class at the masjid, we were talking about
Thursday
tasbih, yeah,
yeah.
And remember, I was saying I have one that I've had 15 years. I paid $4 for it.
Yeah,
wow. I think $3.50 actually.
Like, but it's durable.
But it's durable. I've had to restring it a couple times, but with the same string.
Yeah.
And I may have lost a one or two beads, but I replaced them with something. But it's the one that I use the most.
Yeah.
Yeah. And it's gone through thick and thin with me, traveled all over the world, and it's still, and it's not expensive. It's good quality.
The one thing that we shouldn't take upon is when we take on civilizations, you're going to take on a lot of their culture, but there are mega things in the culture that we should be aware of. So American culture went from like the 50s and 60s to frugality, hard work, right? And I would say a middle, down the middle way of living. That actually produced such great success that the kids, that next generation, came up and frugality and hard work and those virtues and saving is gone, extinct. And then became more of show. Mm-hmm. It became excess and showing. And it became, instead of hard work and frugality, it became almost like reaching heights that your parents could have never imagined. But those heights are not good for you. You're reaching heights and all there is to do is excess. And then it became more of making everyone in the world know and see how awesome you are.
And one of the things about that on a societal level is that when that starts happening, people that are smarter than the rest of us know how to capitalize on that.
Yeah.
Right? So what happens is that consumer goods, including homes.
Exactly. Yeah.
And car, and the prices go up because they're like, we're no longer dealing with the people who are proud of how much they were able to save.
Yeah.
And that's the point of pride. They're proud of how much they have that they can show off.
Yeah.
So let's give them more and more extravagant and more unnecessary. Like every single house, and we're all guilty, every single house now has marble or granite counters in their kitchen. So you cook on that.
Yeah.
This is not, you cook on it.
How many of them have like wood, right?
Or just like something simple where you can, you know, if it gets damaged, you can, you're spending the most expensive stone you can find to like throw food on and chop it with a knife and spill things and put hot pots on. But we all do it because it's the standard now.
It's become a standard.
And the people who remodel homes and who sell homes, it just, if you don't have that, you can't sell your house. So you got to upgrade.
Yeah, and I wish that the crowd that we deal with all the time, which are good people, and they're upon what we believe is true, right? Yeah. Or what is true, I should say. Whether we believed it or not, it's true. The four madhabs and tasawwuf, right? There's a little bit of a too soft, you know, look to them. Like you're just a pushover. You look like a pushover. You're quoting poems, right? And I'm not even saying like Arab poems, right? Like where it's like part of the deen, right? In a sense, it's part of the religious literature. Yeah, yeah. I'm saying like
H.P. Lovecraft.
Who?
The devil worshiper?
Yeah. Like you cite, you know, these delicate lines of poetry.
They quote Rumi as if he's talking to a woman.
Yeah. It's exactly. It's like that. It's too delicate. This is not the time for delicacy, right? This is the time for being a little bit more hearty, right? And longer lasting and simple, right? Don't we get too flowery in our deen and too, we're absorbing a little bit of that West Coast to East Coast culture that's of dilettantes. It's
that West Coast stuff, sure.
I think it's mainly West Coast. I didn't want to throw them under the bus, so I included us just so to be fair about it.
I mean, Allah has blessed that area by sending them Imam Zayd and Sheikh Abdullah.
Yeah, from the East Coast.
From the East Coast, because they needed it. They needed it.
That's true. It reminds me of Andalusia. Like Andalusia, where's all the greatest Islamic art from? Andalusia. What era was it produced in? At the end.
Yeah.
It was not produced in the beginning. It's not like the Sahabi, I mean the Tabi'i, what's his name? The first Tabi'i to go across, I can't remember his name. He was related to Amr ibn As' family. I can't remember his name, subhanAllah. In any event, he's the one who goes to conquer into Andalusia, and then Tariq ibn Ziyad after him, right? It's not like they went in and there was this beautiful Andalusian architecture. It wasn't like that at all. It wasn't like Morocco had this beautiful ornate blue tiles when Muley Idris went and his son established the city of Fez. It was a pretty...
No, the Amazigh people are very like...
It was...
Bedouins.
Bedouin type of thing. Later at the end, when all the wealth and the excess ruined the Andalusians, that's when they were hired to build all these things, and they came up with all these gorgeous designs at the end of their history.
Same with the Ottomans. Same with
then all that stuff spilled down to Morocco after 1492 and before 1492 a little bit too. Yeah. So we have to actually think of that. What we considered the beauty and the symbol of was actually symbol of the downfall, right?
The decadence, yeah.
The decadence. And in fact, and it's not to say that go and take the coasters out of your house and throw them out that have those ornate styles. It's not what we're saying. Right? Alex is taking the coaster right now.
Right? You have a Turkish style one?
Yeah. And
I guess this is Turkish as well.
Yeah, these beautiful Turkish style stuff that you think that the original Ottoman conquerors, you know, were making flowers, were drawing flowers. They're conquerors. They were wielding swords. They were, you know, probably getting strong and learning. Yeah. I think we're in that period. We're not in the period of fluffy duffy stuff, right? Like what I try to make MBIC look like. Is the emphasis is on the lighting. Mm-hmm. Like the spirituality is in the lighting.
Yeah.
And that the color scheme matches.
And it's a big open space, which is beautiful.
Yeah. And other than that, I don't want florals. I don't want little thingies, right? I just want it a simple space. Every item in it is nice. It's like decent. It's not cheap plastic junk.
No.
And no plastic at all in the building is allowed, right? And matching you have to match. Because the eye bothers you, the eye matches.
I was at a masjid. I don't even want to say it. So it had this kind of the tile, the traditional Turkish colors. It's like a deep red, cerulean, and like a medium blue and white. It was like beautiful tile work.
On the wall?
On the walls, right? And then the carpeting was green.
Oh my goodness.
Why?
It drives me insane. How about this? How about there is a masjid. I'm not going to name names. You come from the outside, they have the dome, Indian style. The minaret, and I'm telling you because I took the class, a couple classes in Islamic art and architecture. The dome, Indian style, onion-shaped dome.
Yeah.
The minaret, Mamluk style. I don't know where they got it. Inside, the floor, Andalusian style. Tiles.
Wow.
You go inside now, five different shades of blue or green. It's like, oh my gosh, you guys, you tried, but without knowledge, right? If you transform that art into a fetwa, it would be a disaster. Right? if you combine that into a fiqh, it would be a complete talfiqi disaster. Yeah. If it was a meal, it would be like lobster with hamburger roll or with a hamburger bun, right? And a side of olives. Total confusion.
That's people up in New England. Yeah. They do lobster rolls.
Yeah,
so lobster rolls. It's a hot dog bun.
Yeah.
With lobster and mayonnaise.
But it's like cereal with olives. It's so off. Anyway.
That sounds disgusting.
Yeah, it's disgusting. Well, if you have any sense of Islamic history and where these different designs come from, that's why you're better off being uneducated if you're going to interact with certain places. So I don't want to say, I hate to sound like a dilettante, right?
So.
But that's what it is.
In summary,
consumption,
overconsumption, bad. Meeting the goals that you need to meet for your particular situation, the size of your home, depending on your family, your career, etc. Not going overboard. Not going overboard also in depriving yourself, in spending less than you should for the basic things. Don't be cheap with your family.
Yeah.
And otherwise, you know, Allah has given us limits that we can operate within.
Yeah.
And also find yourself a sheikh so that you can get some more details for your personal life.
Yeah, because these things are
the whole thing.
No, he's 100% right, because these things are exactly changing from decade to decade, not just time to time, decade to decade. These in our world, in the old world, it's century to century, but in our world, it's decade to decade. The norms are changing all the time. So what is fine, what is good, and what is all right? It's going to be by comparison to the righteous, not to the wrong people, but to those who you would want to be like.
So, all right. I think we can wrap up.
All right.
Inshallah. Jazakum khairan, Mashud, for joining us.
Of course.
All right. Assalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh.
Subhanakallahumma wa bihamdika nashhadu an la ilaha illa anta nastaghfiruka wa natubu ilayk. Wal asr inna al insana lafi khusr illa alladhina amanu wa amilus salihat. وتواصوا بالحق وتواصوا بالصبر والسلام عليكم ورحمة الله